know that. Then, sorry, I've no idea why she was in Clerkenwell. Did your sister have any enemies? Jane? I don't think so, no. She never spoke to you of the intrigues at court. Somerset's face hardened. You think that's why she was killed? Because of something to do with the royal family? It's one possibility. Did she ever mention a Dutch courtier named Peter van der Pals? No, never. What about an Italian harpist named Vescovi? You mean Valentino Vescovi? So she did mention him? Not that I recall. But I've heard of him. He's a brilliant musician. What about the Prince of Orange? Did she ever talk about him? Somerset shook his head. No. But as I said, she tended to avoid talking about the royal family around me. She knew my political opinions. So they haven't changed. Your political opinions, I mean. Somerset huffed another soft laugh, only this one contained little real humour. 2 years in prison might make a man more circumspect about voicing his thoughts, but it's not likely to kindle within him warm feelings for the system that put him there now, is it? My wife died while I was in Newgate. She's the one who set up the bookshop and started publishing novels and guidebooks in an effort to make ends meet while I was in prison. She was amazingly successful at it, but in the end it all got to be too much for her. She died 6 weeks before I was released. I'm sorry, said Sebastian, letting his gaze travel again around the office. It did much to explain the shift in Somerset's printing business. He had simply picked up where his dead wife had left off. I gather your sister was quite close to your former partner, Liam Maxwell. Somerset was quiet for a moment, as if carefully choosing his words. I know what you're implying, but you're wrong. Liam and I have been friends since we were schoolboys, and he and Jane got to know each other particularly well during our time in Newgate. But our father was a profoundly religious man, who brought up his children with strict Christian precepts. Most of his teachings didn't stick so well with me, but they did with Jane. She was a sincerely devout woman who took her marriage vows seriously. She would never have been unfaithful to her husband. Did you know that Edward Ambrose used to hit her hard enough to leave bruises? Somerset gave a faint shake of his head. I didn't know for certain, no. But I'll not deny I suspected it. His jaw tightened. That bloody bastard. If he were to be found dead in the middle of the street, I wouldn't shed a tear. I can tell you that. I gather your relationship with Ambrose is strained. Somerset grunted. Now, there's an understatement. I can assure you that if I were found dead, you wouldn't see him shedding any tears either. Was he faithful to his wife? Somerset hesitated. Was he? Said Sebastian. Somerset sucked in a deep breath. I've heard he's involved with some actress or opera dancer, although that could be nothing but talk. Did Jane hear it? I never said anything to her about it, if that's what you're asking. And if she heard it from someone else, she never mentioned it to me. Would she, do you think? Mention it to me? He paused for a moment, then shook his head a bit wistfully. Probably not. We were close in many ways, but I don't think she'd tell me something like that. From the workshop behind them came a clatter, followed by a boy's laughter. Sebastian said, "Do you think the rumours are true, that Ambrose is involved with someone?" Somerset met his gaze, his features drawn and tight with what looked like anger. "Yes, yes, I do." Chapter 17. By the time Sebastian left Somerset's workshop, dark, ominous clouds were once again pressing down on the city. He turned his steps west toward the theatre district of Covent Garden, intending to make some inquiries there about Edward Ambrose. But as he left Ave Maria Lane for Ludgate Street, he began to suspect he was being followed. The cold had driven enough people off the streets to make the man behind him particularly noticeable. Short and stocky, with sandy hair and a slouch hat pulled low over his eyes, he looked much like a respectable tradesman. He stayed perhaps 20 feet behind Sebastian, close enough to keep him in sight without being too obvious. But when Sebastian quickened his step, the man walked faster. When Sebastian allowed his pace to slacken, the man likewise slowed. The slouch-hatted shadow followed Sebastian up Ludgate to Fleet Street. After another 2 blocks, Sebastian swung about to stride rapidly back the way he had come. Slouch hat paused and turned, as if in rapt admiration of the parasols displayed in the bow window of the shop beside him. Sebastian walked right up to him.
"So, who the hell are you, and why are you following me?"
The man gave an exaggerated start of surprise.
"Your Honor?"
"You heard me. Who are you working for?"
"I wasn't full."
Sebastian grabbed the man's shoulder and swung him around to slam his back against the soot-stained brick wall beside them.
"I suggest you don't try my patience," he said, enunciating each word carefully. "A brilliant young woman is dead, and I am in no mood to play games. Who set you to following me?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
The man tried to pull away, but Sebastian hauled him back and wedged a forearm up beneath the man's chin.
"Not so fast."
The man squirmed in his grasp.
"Oi, let me go.
When you tell me who..." Sebastian broke off as he caught the crunch of snow-muffled footsteps coming up behind him fast. The man's gaze shifted for one telltale instant to something over Sebastian's shoulder just as Sebastian heard the unmistakable snick of a blade being drawn from its leather sheath.
"Bloody hell," swore Sebastian.
Grabbing Slouch Hat by his coat, he pulled the man away from the wall and swung around just as a tall, lanky man, with a scarf wrapped around the lower half of his face, lunged at Sebastian with a dagger. Such was the speed and force of the attack that the assassin was unable to break away. Sebastian felt the man in the slouch hat shudder under the impact of the blade. Blood poured from the man's mouth as he pitched forward to knock Sebastian off his feet and land on top of him.
"Jack!"
shouted the lanky man, trying to yank the dagger from his friend's back as Sebastian fought to shove the stricken man away. Over the folds of his woolen scarf, the assassin's gaze met Sebastian's. Filled with murderous rage, the man's eyes were oddly mismatched, one noticeably larger than the other and not quite on the same plane. Then the killer abandoned his knife and ran. Sebastian scrambled up from under the dying man.
"Who sent you?"
said Sebastian, raising the man's head so that he wouldn't choke on his own blood.
"Who sent you, damn it?"
The man's mouth worked. Sebastian bent over him, only to jerk back his head as the man tried to spit in his face. Then the light of rage and hatred faded from the man's eyes, leaving nothing but the cold, vacant stare of death.
"So who is he?"
asked Sir Henry Lovejoy some time later, as the two men stood side by side staring down at the dead man at their feet. The snow fell around them in a sibilant rush.
"Jack, according to the man who accidentally killed him," said Sebastian. "But beyond that, I've no idea. I've never seen him before, and he's not carrying any identification." "And his companion?"
"Was likewise unknown to me, as far as I could tell. He had a scarf covering most of his face, but his eyes were definitely memorable."
Lovejoy frowned at the spreading pool of crimson snow around the dead man.
"You'll need to testify at the inquest, of course."
"Yes."
"Any idea who might want to have you killed?"
"None."
Lovejoy pursed his lips.
"Well, at least Bow Street can get involved in this death. I don't see why the palace should object."
"Unless, of course, the palace sent him," said Sebastian.
The two men's gazes met, but rather than say anything, Lovejoy simply burrowed his fists deeper into his pockets and blew out a harsh breath that rose in a white cloud to freeze on his eyelashes. Hero was buttoning the tucked bodice of a fine black wool carriage gown when Sebastian came to stand in her dressing room's doorway.
She glanced over at him, and then went back to her buttons.
So, is that your blood all over you, or someone else's?
He walked over to inspect his face in the mirror above the washstand.
Someone else's.
He reached for the pitcher and poured water into the bowl.
Two men just tried to kill me in Fleet Street. One of them got away. The other didn't.
He's dead?
He is. Unfortunately, he died without revealing whom he was working for.
She watched him dab at the streak of blood on his cheek with a wet cloth.
Any idea who that might be?
Not really. At the moment, the most likely suspect in Jane's death is probably her own husband, Edward Ambrose. But he doesn't know that I suspect him, so why would he try to kill me?
He glanced over at her.
Where are you off to?
Clerkenwell. Coachman John thinks he can get me there in the sleigh, so I've had cook pack a basket of food.
For the cooper's wife who gave birth on Thursday?
Yes.
She reached for her hat and pivoted back to her dressing table to position it just so.
I'm also taking a sack of coal. I don't know how the poor of the city are surviving with everything either impossible to find or dreadfully dear.
She turned to face him again, her grey eyes troubled.
What?
He asked, watching her. It's just that I have the most luring reflection that I'm doing this simply as a pitiful sop to my own conscience. In the grand scheme of things, what does it matter if I help one desperate mother and her children when thousands more are starving and freezing to death?
It's a beginning.
He went to take her face in his hands and gently kiss her mouth.
Be careful, will you?
He said, his gaze locking with hers.
I'm not the one somebody just tried to kill.
You be careful. Chapter 18. It was still snowing when Sebastian reached Covent Garden, big soft flakes that drifted lazily down on the city. This was a part of London he'd known as well as a young man just down from Oxford, when he'd fallen hopelessly in love with a brilliant unknown young actress named Kat Boleyn. At the time, he had expected to spend the rest of his life with her, have children with her, grow old with her. Then a series of well-intentioned lies tore them apart and very nearly destroyed him. It had been a dark period in his life, one he didn't like to remember. But in time, he'd learned that a powerful and enriching love can come into a man's life more than once. And gradually, his affection for Kat had shifted from something passionate and desperate to something warm and good, as if she were indeed the half-sister he'd once believed her to be. Now the most acclaimed actress of London stage, Kat was currently starring in the title role of Queen Boudicca at Covent Garden Theatre. And it was there that he found her, sorting through a medley collection of dusty stage props in the warren of frigid rooms below the stairs. She was in her mid-twenties now, a beautiful woman with rich auburn hair, her father's vivid blue eyes, and a wide mouth that curled into a welcoming smile when she turned and spotted him picking his way toward her through piles of battered shields and wooden swords jumbled together with papier-mâché horses' heads and a stuffed raven.
"I was wondering when I'd be seeing you," she said.
"Oh, are you becoming prescient?"
"I've no need to be. No one in the theatre can talk of anything other than Jane Ambrose's death and your interest in it."
She set aside the elaborate headpiece of beads, tarnished wire and feathers she'd been trying to straighten.
"So it's true. Was she murdered?"
"It was either murder or manslaughter."
He tripped over a crate of masks and collided with a rusty suit of armour.
"Did you know her?"
Kat reached out to steady the rocking armour.
"I did, but not well. I've no idea who could have killed her, if that's what you're asking."
He found himself next to a big old wooden chest and promptly sat on it. It was cold enough down here that he could see his breath.
"What about her husband, Edward Ambrose? Do you know him?"
"Ambrose, of course. His plays and operas are brilliant. I've been in half a dozen or more of them over the years."
"What about the man himself? What do you think of him?"
She took her time in answering.
It was one of the things she had in common with her natural father, the Earl of Hendon, this tendency to think carefully and weigh her words before speaking.
He's well-liked in the theatre, which is unusual, because not many writers are. He has a reputation for being affable and easygoing.
You say that as if you disagree with the general consensus.
Oh, I won't deny he comes across as quite pleasant. But I've never been entirely convinced it's genuine.
Any particular reason?
I don't know if I could point to any one thing. It's probably more a feeling I've had.
She shivered and clutched the thin shawl she wore tightly around her shoulders.
You think he killed his own wife?
He's certainly on my list. There's a rumor he has a mistress, possibly an actress or an opera dancer. Do you know if that's true?
I've heard whispers, but I don't know for certain, no.
Could you find out?
I can try.
Another shiver racked her frame, chattering her teeth together. He shrugged off his greatcoat and dropped it around her shoulders.
How about if we continue this conversation over a nice hot cup of tea?
She laughed.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
They sought refuge in a nearby coffee house with a roaring fire and the welcoming aroma of freshly baked scones. She was on her second scone when she said casually, without looking up,
"There's something else you wanted to ask me about, isn't there?"
He smiled, because she had always known him so well. Dropping his voice, he leaned in closer over the table. "I need to talk to a smuggler familiar with Rothschild's operation in the Channel. I don't mean one of his confederates, but a competitor. Someone who would be willing to tell me what I need to know." The request might have struck a casual listener as beyond bizarre. But then, few in London knew that as a fierce Irish patriot, Cat had once passed information to the French, or that she was a widow of a flamboyant ex-privateer who dabbled in smuggling himself.
"You think Rothschild could be involved in her death?"
"It's possible. Can you find someone?" A flicker of something unidentifiable crossed her features, but all she said was, "Give me a few days." After that, they talked for a time of Simon's coming birthday and Hendon's recent attack of the gout. Then Cat fell silent, her face thoughtful.
"What?"
"I was remembering one of the reasons why I'd come to doubt Edward Ambrose's reputation as a genial man. About a year or so ago, when we were doing his Fool's Paradise, his wife was at the theatre helping organise the costumes. He got into a disagreement with her over something, and I saw him take hold of her wrist and twist it hard enough that she gave a small gasp."
"It was deliberate."
"Oh, yes. And what made it particularly chilling is that he was smiling all the time he did it."
"Lovely."
She nodded. "I saw him do something similar just a few days ago."
"When?"
"Tuesday evening. I was walking past the opera and noticed them standing at the top of the steps beneath the portico. It was raining, and I wasn't near enough to hear what they were saying, but it was obvious the conversation was tense. He grabbed her by both arms and shook her, quite hard, and then she pulled from his grasp and ran away. It was beginning to get dark, but I could see her face well enough as she passed to know that she was crying."
"Bloody hell," said Sebastian.
Cat met his gaze, her features solemn.
"If he did kill her, I hope you can prove it."
Sebastian took a swallow of his tea, found it cold, and pushed the cup aside.
"Believe me, I'm trying."
Sebastian turned his steps once more towards Soho Square. The snow was falling now in wind-blown swirls, a billowing curtain of white lit by a strange light that seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere. It was only midday, but he found himself walking through nearly deserted streets, the ice stinging his cheeks, his breath a frozen mist that hovered around him.
Where did they all go?
He found himself wondering. The tradesmen and cart drivers, costermongers and paupers, whose voices normally echoed through the narrow, canyon-like streets of the city. For how long could they continue to seek refuge from a winter too brutal to be borne? before they began to starve, go mad, die. He walked on, his shoulders hunched against the driven snow as he tried to put together the puzzle of Jane Ambrose's death with 3/4 of its pieces still missing. In the last 48 hours, his grasp of the woman she once was had begun to strengthen. The reality of her life and the way she'd lived it, emerging like a shadowy form still half hidden by a storm. He saw a talented musician denied the brilliant career that could have been hers had she only been born male, and a devout, loving mother, faithfully honouring her religion by enduring an unhappy marriage, only to then be devastated by the loss of both her children. How could such a woman come to terms with that blow, he wondered. Impossible to do, surely, without questioning every assumption, every platitude by which she'd always sought to live. Jane's brother swore she'd taken her marriage vows too seriously to ever think of leaving her husband or taking a lover. But had that remained true? Would Christian Somerset know if it did not? Jane's husband had made a practice of hitting her, hurting her. What would a man such as Edward Ambrose do if he discovered his wife's infidelity, or suspected it? Hit her in the face? Rape her? Kill her? Chapter 19. The body of Jane Ambrose lay in a silk-lined coffin set up on 2 straight-backed wooden chairs before the dining-room windows overlooking Soho Square. Her face was like wax, her body shrinking in on itself, so that she looked diminished, so much less than the vibrant woman she'd been in life. The laying-out woman had dressed her in a high-necked gown of simple black muslin, with a black lace-trimmed bonnet that effectively hid both the shattered side of her skull and the exploratory incisions from Alexis Sauvage's abbreviated post-mortem examination. The strange, inexplicable burns on her hand were covered by fine black gloves. Any other secrets her body might have had to tell were hidden, and would never be known. Edward Ambrose stood beside his dead wife's coffin, his gaze on her still, pale face. His shoulders were slumped, his cravat askew, and he looked up at Sebastian's entrance to show an unshaven face with eyes swollen as if from lack of sleep. He gave all the appearance of a man devastated by the death of a wife he loved. But then, Sebastian had seen men weep inconsolably at the gravesides of women they'd killed. "My apologies for the intrusion," said Sebastian, pausing just inside the dining-room door, his hat in his hands. Ambrose nodded, his lips pressed tightly together. "I understand it's necessary." "Is there a place we can talk?" asked Sebastian. He saw a flicker of something in Ambrose's bloodshot eyes that was there and then gone. "Yes, of course." The playwright led the way to a crowded library dominated by 2 pianofortes. Sheet music lay scattered everywhere, along with stacks of books, several violins, and a flute. "Have you discovered something?" he asked, turning to face Sebastian. He did not invite him to sit. "Actually, yes. I'm hearing reports that you have a mistress. Is that true?" Ambrose's head jerked back. "Good God, no!" Sebastian studied the other man's suddenly high colour and tightened jaw. "Let me give you some advice. When it comes to murder, it's never a good idea to lie. It makes you look guilty." Ambrose straightened his shoulders, his nostrils flaring wide as if he were working to keep his temper in check, and his voice even. "I do not keep a mistress." "If you do, I will find out about it eventually. You do realize that, don't you?" "I do not keep a mistress, and I did not kill my wife. That's what you're insinuating, isn't it?" Sebastian let his gaze drift around the room, taking in again the multiple musical instruments, the basket of mending beside the hearth. It looked very much like a space Jane had shared with her husband, rather than the private retreat he had insinuated the last time Sebastian had spoken with him. "You had a quarrel with Jane late Tuesday on the steps of the opera. A quarrel that ended with you shaking her and her in tears. And don't even think about trying to deny it, because you were seen by someone I know and trust. Ambrose walked away to stand looking out the window at the narrow, snow-filled garden to the rear of the house. Husbands and wives quarrel. Why should I deny it?
What was the quarrel about?
If I tell you, you must assure me that it will go no further.
Within reason, of course.
Ambrose hesitated, then said, I was angry because Jane had paid a visit to the Princess of Wales. Whatever Sebastian had been expecting, it wasn't that. Caroline, Princess of Wales, was the Regent's estranged wife and mother to Princess Charlotte. Once she had been highly sought after by members of the Ton, an enthusiastic hostess famous for giving unusual, amusing dinner parties, frequented by everyone from men of letters such as Lord Byron and Walter Scott, to the painter Thomas Lawrence, and Whig politicians like Brougham and Wallace. But when the Prince of Wales became regent, most of society dropped her cold. Few cared to alienate the prince, who was now both head of state and head of the royal family, and who had a reputation for holding a grudge forever and exacting petty revenges. The regent's patronage is important to a man in my profession, Ambrose was saying. You know the way he treats those who dare have anything to do with Caroline. What husband in my position wouldn't have been angry?
When did Jane visit Charlotte's mother?
I don't recall precisely.
Sometime last week. Why?
Ambrose looked as if the question puzzled him.
I've no idea. What does it matter why she went? Do you imagine the prince cares what her motives might have been?
It matters if it had something to do with her death. Ambrose brought up a hand to rub his forehead.
Oh, yes, of course. I wasn't thinking of that.
No, I can see you weren't. A faint flush touched the other man's cheeks, but he remained silent.
Did you know Lord Wallace was planning to employ Jane to instruct one of her daughters?
Wallace! What looked like a habitual kind of fury hardened the other man's eyes.
No, she didn't tell me. Good God, what was she thinking?
To deal with someone who has made himself such a public enemy of the prince, you mean?
Yes.
Perhaps she didn't care. Obviously. Any chance she was romantically involved with another man? Ambrose let his hand drop, his jaw tightening.
You can't be serious. What are you suggesting now?
The playwright was either oblivious to his wife's friendship with Liam Maxwell or very good at hiding uncomfortable truths he didn't want known. Rather than answer, Sebastian said, A day or two before she was killed, your wife was raped.
Did you know?
Ambrose stared at him.
No. She didn't say anything to you about it.
Good Lord, no!
It wasn't you by any chance, was it?
Ambrose took a hasty step forward, his hands curling into fists.
I should call you out for that.
I wouldn't advise it, said Sebastian dryly.
Get out! Get out of my house, now!
Sebastian inclined his head and turned toward the door. But he paused to glance back and say,
One more thing. You told me you were here on Thursday afternoon, but I don't recall your saying where you were that evening.
Ambrose stayed where he was, his breath coming in hard, angry pants.
I was still here, damn you.
In your library, working on your libretto?
Yes.
Alone?
Of course.
In a household such as this, without a butler or footman, the door was typically answered by a housemaid with numerous other duties, which meant that Ambrose could easily have left the house and come back hours later without any of the servants knowing. Sebastian said,
I'm curious as to why you led me to believe Jane's family was dead, when her brother, Christian Somerset, is still very much alive.
Why do you think? For the same reason I objected to her visit to Princess Caroline.
Yes, of course.
And how did you learn of that visit, by the way?
Jane mentioned it to me.
On the steps of the opera? Ambrose hesitated a moment too long, then said,
Yes. Without also mentioning why she went. I told her I didn't want to know.
Oh? Why is that?
Ambrose gave a short, bitter laugh.
You should know as well as anyone the swirl of intrigue that surrounds Carolyn.
Are you suggesting Jane was involved in that?
I don't know, and frankly, I don't care to know. If you think it's so important, I suggest you ask the princess yourself.
I intend to, said Sebastian.
Ambrose simply stared back at him, his jaw set hard and his eyes now hooded. Chapter 20. Wrapped in a warm carriage robe and with a hot brick at her feet, Hero crossed the frozen city in a horse-drawn sleigh. The farther east she travelled, the more wretched were the snow-filled lanes and courts, the more desperate the bleak eyes raised to watch her pass. This part of the city had long been a crumbling, overcrowded morass of grinding, soul-destroying poverty and aching want. Now, after endless, paralyzing weeks of cold, life there was becoming unbearably grim. Near St. Giles, a water main had broken during the night, flooding the street with what had become a thick sheet of ice. Those few lucky children with shoes were running and sliding across the frozen surface, arms windmilling, voices shrieking with laughter. But their mothers stood watching solemnly, faces tight with fear. For a broken main meant no water in addition to no food and no heat. Jenny Sanborn, the Cooper's wife Hero was coming to see, lived at the end of a noisome alley in a miserable one-room hovel that looked as if it had been built as a lean-to shed for animals. When they drew up before the shed's rough door, Hero could hear the muffled sounds of a woman weeping within. Exchanging a quick glance with her coachman, Hero looped the handle of her food basket over one arm and went to knock on the door. The door was opened by a skinny, ragged girl of about 6, whom Hero remembered from the other night.
Hello, said Hero, crouching down until she was level with the child. You're Sarah, aren't you? I've brought your mum a present.
Then Hero looked beyond the little girl to where the mother, Jenny Sanborn, lay curled up in a ball on the room's only pallet. The woman was as thin as a fence board, with limp fair hair, and a face swollen and blotched with tears. She was probably no more than 30, although she looked 50 or more. Her newborn babe lay beside her, and Hero didn't need more than a swift glance to tell her the child was dead.
When? Hero asked.
The woman dragged in a ragged breath that shuddered her thin chest.
Last night.
Hero rose slowly to her feet, her throat so tight she couldn't seem to force out any words.
Is all that food for us?
Asked the little girl, her eyes round.
Sarah,
began her mother.
It is.
Yes, said Hero, summoning up a smile that trembled a bit around the edges as she handed the basket to the girl.
And my coachman's got a bag of coal for you as well.
Coal,
breathed one of the girl's brothers, coming to stand beside her.
I don't rightly know how to thank you, said Jenny Sanborn, pushing herself up with difficulty. Your ladyship has already done so much for us. We'd never have made it through this dreadful cold spell without you.
Hero wanted to say,
Please don't thank me. For a sack of coal and a simple basket of food I will never even miss.
Do you have any idea how guilty I feel, knowing that women like me will never be in danger of seeing our husbands snatched off the streets and forced to serve in a war that means nothing to them? Knowing I'll never need to worry about my son growing up to someday suffer the same fate? I should be here begging your forgiveness. We all should, although no one ever will. Except, of course, she could say none of these things. So she said instead, This freeze can't last much longer. and it sounded so weak even to her own ears that she wished she'd said nothing at all.
"You did what you could," Alexei said later that afternoon as she and Hero walked beside the frozen moat of the Tower of London.
Hero shook her head, her exhalation billowing around her in the cold air.
"It wasn't enough." "No, but we can only try. One woman, one child at a time."
Hero turned to stare out over the masts of the ships frozen fast in the river below London Bridge. "This blasted war. Sometimes I think it will never end. For how many years can the nations of Europe continue fighting each other? Some of the men dying today must be the grandsons of those who fell 2 decades ago."
"What a horrid thought."
"It is, isn't it?" They walked on in silence, each lost in her own thoughts, the air heavy with the smell of wood smoke from the fires lit in an attempt to keep the tower's lions and other exotic animals alive. The surrounding streets were nearly deserted, the battlements of the castle walls stark and empty against the heavy white sky. But Hero was becoming increasingly aware of a creeping feeling of unease that she finally realized came from a sense of being stared at. Although when she looked around, she could see no one.
"What is it?"
Alexei asked when Hero looked behind her for the third or fourth time.
"I don't know. I have the oddest sensation, as if someone were watching me."
Alexei let her gaze drift over the rows of ancient houses pressing in on the castle.
"I don't see anyone."
"Nor do I.
I'm probably being fanciful."
"You? That I find impossible to believe."
Hero smiled.
"How is your article coming?"
asked Alexei. "Honestly, I've barely given it a thought." Alexei squinted up at the heavy clouds pressing down on the city.
"Are you still interested in interviewing the wives of men who've been impressed?"
Hero glanced over at her.
"I am, yes. You know of another woman?"
The French woman nodded.
"A young girl named Amy Atcher. She's originally from Devon, but after her baby was born, she came up to London, hoping to trace her husband. If you want to talk to her, we'll need to hurry."
"Why? Is she ill?" Alexei's lips flattened into a hard line.
"She's in Newgate. She was arrested before Christmas trying to steal a ham and is scheduled to hang on Tuesday."
Sebastian arrived back at Brook Street to find Hero seated at his desk and calmly cleaning the brass-mounted flintlock pistol given to her years before by her father. It was a small weapon of a type known as a muff gun, designed to be carried concealed in a woman's fur muff.
"Is this routine maintenance?" he asked, watching her. "Or did you shoot someone?"
Hero carefully replaced the barrel and locked it in place.
"I think someone might be following me. I don't know for certain because I didn't see them. But under the circumstances, I thought it best not to take any chances."
Sebastian tried to keep any sign of the raw panic he felt flare within him from showing in his face.
"I'll assign two of the footmen to..."
"No," she said, setting the pistol aside and wiping her hands. "But..."
She gave him a long, steady look. "Someone tried to kill you earlier today. Do you intend to take two footmen with you wherever you go from now on?" He found himself smiling.
"Point taken. But you will be careful."
"I suspect I'll be far more cautious than you," she said, returning his smile. And he realized that was another point he couldn't argue. That night, unable to sleep, Hero stood at her bedroom window as a fresh fall of snow hurtled down from out of a heavy white sky. She thought it must be near dawn, although it had been hours since she'd heard the watchers cry. She hoped the old man had retreated to his box for warmth. Either that, or he'd frozen to death. She clutched her cashmere wrap tighter against the cold radiating off the frosted glass. Frustration and sorrow swirled within her, along with a healthy dose of raw, throbbing anger. She heard the shifting of the mattress behind her, felt Devlin's arms slide around her waist to draw her back against his warm, hard body. He kissed her hair and said simply,
hero.
She tipped her head back against his shoulder, her throat so tight it hurt. I've always thought of myself as a fiercely rational being, driven by intellect rather than emotion and sentimentality. But I'm beginning to wonder if perhaps I don't know myself quite as well as I've always believed. Any other man would assume she was spooked at the thought that someone was following her. But Devlin knew her well. He pressed a kiss against her neck.
Discovering that a babe you fought so hard to save has died anyway would be enough to overset most people.
But I'm not supposed to be like most people, she said with a wry smile. The smile faded. Alexei warned me the baby would die, that he was too tiny, too poorly nourished in the womb to survive. But I'd hoped, if I could help his mother... He nuzzled his face against her neck.
I know.
It's not right what we do. Kidnapping men and carrying them off as essentially slaves to serve on our warships, all without a thought to the wives and children they leave behind to starve. As if their hopes and dreams, as if their very lives matter not at all. We killed that baby. Everyone who has ever kept silent about impressment, who accepts it as just or even an unfortunate necessity. We killed him.
That's why you're writing this article.
She felt tears sting her eyes.
I fear it won't do any good.
Not right away, no. But it's a start. If no one criticizes or even questions the wrongs of our society, it will never change. Sometimes I wonder if I'm simply tilting at windmills.
Only sometimes.
She gave a soft gurgle of laughter and turned in his arms to hug his naked male body close. You'll catch cold, she said, sliding her splayed hands over the now icy flesh of his back.
I'm tough.
She lifted her head to meet his gaze. He had the most beautiful eyes, a rich tawny gold, with an animal's ability to see clearly in the dark and over great distances. Strange, feral eyes that had captivated her from the moment she first saw him. She said, "Make love to me." Wordlessly, he took her hand and drew her to the fire's side. There, in the warm glow from the coals, he cradled her face in his palms. Tenderly, he kissed her eyelids, kissed cheeks wet with tears she hadn't even realized she'd let fall. Then his mouth took hers, gentleness giving way to a growing hunger and carnal urgency. She was dimly aware of the shawl slipping from her shoulders as his hands swept over her. She pressed herself against him, one leg coming up to wrap around his thigh. With a groan, he bore her down before the fire, his body covering hers. Her world filled with firelight gleaming golden over hot, sweaty flesh, catching breaths, and an exquisitely tightening spiral of pleasure. It was a desperate affirmation of life in the face of death, of love in the face of selfish indifference and greed. And afterward, as he cradled her in his arms, she slept. Sunday, 30th of January. The next morning dawned clear and calm, but paralyzingly cold. Hero ate a simple breakfast, then took refuge with Simon beside the fire in the morning room.
"Who's the birthday boy?" she cooed,
bouncing the baby up and down in her lap.
"Kakaji,"
he gurgled, reaching out a hand toward the big black cat that sauntered up to sit tantalizingly just out of the boy's reach.
"Shame on you, Mr. Darcy," said Hero,
as the cat flicked his magnificent tail back and forth, his slitted green eyes on the child. "You are a heartless tease."
"Kakaji," said Simon again.
Hero stared at the cat as enlightenment dawned. Good heavens!
"Mr. Darcy, he's Gagaji."
"Gagaji,"
agreed the boy, squirming now to get down.
"One-year-old and beyond brilliant," said Devlin,
joining her with a cup of tea in his hand, and the look of a man whose morning ablutions had been less than satisfactory.
"Calhoun tells me the water pipes of the house are frozen. I suppose we should be thankful they didn't break."
"Not yet." Hero set Simon on his feet, and they watched the boy totter over to the cat. "According to the footman who went out this morning to fetch water, the river has frozen so solid that some brave souls are venturing out onto the ice, and the bridges are packed with people watching them." Unfortunately, they told this tale within the hearing of the scullery maid, who immediately fell into hysterics, convinced it's never going to warm up, and we're all going to die.
"Lovely," said Devlin,
his eyes narrowing as Simon plopped down beside the cat. Mr. Darcy stretched to his feet and butted his head against the baby's hand with an uncharacteristically loud purr. Mr. Darcy virtually never purred. Hero's gaze met Devlin's, and they both laughed. She watched as he set aside his teacup and pushed to his feet. She said, "You're going to ask the Princess of Wales about Jane?"
"I am."
Swooping down, he swung his squealing, laughing son high in the air. "Hopefully, with a better part of the city's population ogling the river, there will be no one to see me put myself beyond the pale by paying a visit to Her Ostracized Highness." Chapter 21. A new bank of heavy white clouds was beginning to roll in over the city as Sebastian drove the sleigh out to Connaught House, the current residence of the Prince of Wales's estranged wife. She'd been born Caroline of Brunswick, daughter of the late Duke of Brunswick, an enlightened continental ruler who was also a famous and respected German general, and his somewhat silly wife, Princess Augusta, sister of Britain's own George III. At the age of 27, Caroline had been sent to England to marry her first cousin, whom she had never seen. Things had gone badly from the very beginning. In a move that was surely deliberately calculated to humiliate his bride, the prince had sent his mistress, Lady Jersey, to meet Caroline's ship. He'd further shown his contempt for his new wife by taking Lady Jersey along on their honeymoon and forcing the princess to accept his mistress as her lady of the bedchamber. Simple, good-natured Caroline, homesick and lonely, and not particularly wise, was no match for the exquisite, brilliant, and thoroughly nasty Lady Jersey. Sebastian thought it a tribute to Caroline's fortitude that she'd not only survived her husband's mistreatment, but managed to win the love and support of the British people. Of course, the more they loved Caroline, the more the people hated the Prince of Wales. It became one more thing her royal husband held against her. They had lived apart now for 17 years. At first, the prince had allowed Caroline to see her daughter once a day. Then he'd restricted their visits to once a week, then once a fortnight, then every 3 weeks. Frequently, the visits were suspended entirely for months at a time, while correspondence between mother and daughter was strictly forbidden. Sebastian suspected it was one of the main reasons Princess Charlotte's tutors, servants, and ladies were always being sacked, because they were suspected of smuggling letters between the lonely young princess and her mother. Caroline's newest residence, Connaught House, lay on the northern side of Bayswater Road, overlooking the ancient hanging site of Tyburn and the rolling expanse of Hyde Park beyond that.
"Cool," said Tom,
his face tight and solemn as he stared at the former location of the infamous scaffold.
"I wouldn't want to look out my window every morning and see that."
Sebastian handed his tiger the reins and dropped to the ground.
"Perhaps princesses aren't as intimidated by gallows as the rest of us."
Although even as he said it, it occurred to Sebastian that this particular princess probably had more reason to fear than most. If the Prince of Wales, with Jarvis's assistance, could have connived it, Caroline would have been dead long ago. Given Sebastian's connections to Jarvis, he wouldn't have been surprised if she had refused to receive him. But after a few minutes' wait, He was shown to a small, light-filled room with a row of tall windows overlooking a snowy rear garden. Carolyn, wearing a plain old fustian gown and a decidedly ratty mob cap, stood at a low table near the windows and was busy sculpting a man's head out of clay.
"I hope you don't mind if I keep working," she said, grinning as she held up hands stained with the clay.
Despite being the descendant and niece of British kings and a resident of England herself for almost 19 years, Carolyn's German accent was still quite heavy.
"Your Royal Highness," Sebastian executed a low, courtly bow. "Thank you for agreeing to see me."
She gave a loud, hearty laugh.
"If you knew how few visitors I receive these days, you would not be as surprised as you appear."
Sebastian found himself smiling. There was nothing arrogant, pretentious, subtle, or subdued about Carolyn. She had never been a beauty, although most people acknowledged that in her youth she was pretty, with a fresh complexion, deep-set blue eyes, and fine fair hair. But the intervening years had coarsened her figure and ground down her once sunny, effervescent good humour beneath the endless pressures of heartache, loneliness, boredom, frustration, and fear. Prinny had twice tried to divorce her by unsuccessfully charging her with adultery, the penalty for which would have been death. Now her eyes narrowed as she looked Sebastian over with a frankly assessing and openly curious gaze. "Why are you here?" His answer was as blunt as her question.
"Jane Ambrose was found dead on Thursday, Your Highness. All indications are that she was killed. But because she was Princess Charlotte's piano instructor, the palace will not allow her death to be investigated."
"It was murder."
"Mein Gott," whispered Carolyn, her hands stilling on the bust.
"Poor Jane."
"Did you know her well?"
"Yes, of course I've known Jane for years."
Carolyn herself had a reputation for playing the piano extraordinarily well. In fact, when she was younger, in Germany, she'd studied with a number of famous masters, practicing faithfully 4 and more hours a day. Now her eyebrows drew together in a troubled frown.
"Why will the palace not allow an investigation?"
"Ostensibly, their motive is to prevent any hint of scandal from touching the princess. But it's also possible they're hiding something."
Carolyn was silent for a moment, her attention seemingly all for her sculpture again. She might have been an unexpectedly simple woman, but she was not stupid. And she'd been dealing with Prinny's plots, machinations, lies, and schemes for the better part of 2 decades. Her gaze still on her work, she said slowly,
"You've heard that fat pig of a husband of mine tricked Charlotte into agreeing to marry Orange?"
"I heard the regent had pressured her."
"Oh, he more than pressured her. He tricked her. He likes to say he promised never to try to force her into a distasteful marriage. But what do you call it when your father shouts at his daughter, calling her an obstinate, silly fool, while threatening to shut her up for life if she doesn't marry?"
"Would he do that to her?"
"Of course he would do it. He cares for no one but himself, and that nasty mother of his, I suppose," she added, as an afterthought.
When Sebastian refrained from comment, she said, "Last December, he made Charlotte agree to meet Orange at a dinner party at Carlton House, and then pushed her into promising she'd give him an answer about the match that very evening."
Her nostrils flared with indignation.
"Who does that?"
"So what happened?"
"Charlotte saw Orange for 2 hours, 2 hours at a dinner, attended by a number of others, including Liverpool and his wife. And then, with everyone still there, Vales pulls her aside and says, 'Well, what do you think of him?'"
"What did she think?"
"How could she know after such a short time as that?
And her just 17 years old. She was still considering how to form her answer when Prinny says,
'What? He will not do?'
'And my poor girl,' she says, 'I don't say that. I like his manner from what I have seen.'"
Carolyn shook her head, the muscles in her cheeks bunching as she thrust her jaw forward in disgust.
"Now, does that sound to you as if she was agreeing to the match?"
"Of course not,"
But Vales, he's a clever one. He throws his arms around the child and exclaims, "You make me the happiest person in the world." Poor Charlotte is still stuttering, trying to tell him she meant no such thing when that nasty, sly bastard calls over Liverpool and announces that she has agreed. And then he brings over Orange himself, joins their hands, and gives the couple his blessing.
Sebastian had no difficulty imagining the scene. It was just the sort of dishonest manipulation for which Prinny was famous. Caroline made a decidedly ungenteel noise.
Needless to say, Charlotte is in a rage with him. But it's done, isn't it? She can't back out after that. Not with her father telling the Prime Minister and Orange himself that she's agreed. And to make matters worse, not 24 hours later she discovers that Orange intends to require her to leave England and live in Holland. Prinny was aware of the scheme long, of course, but was careful not to let her know.
Sebastian stared at her.
Live abroad? The heiress presumptive to the throne?
Caroline nodded.
It's the real reason the prince wants this particular marriage for her, to get Charlotte out of the country.
Her breathing had become agitated, her full heavy breasts heaving above the shockingly low-cut bodice of her gown.
Part of it is because she is so much more popular than he, and he's jealous. But it's also because he thinks that with Charlotte gone, I will leave too, so that he will finally be able to push through his divorce. Then he will marry again and have a son, a new heir to the throne who will dispossess my daughter.
She gave a derisive snort.
Not that he has much chance of that. He could barely consummate our marriage 19 years ago, and look at him now.
It had long been whispered that Prinny's sexual performance on his wedding night had been far from satisfactory, and that Caroline had handled her bridegroom's bruised amour propre with all the sensitivity to be expected of a woman who'd just been forced to sit down to her wedding feast in the company of her husband's beautiful, waspish mistress. Prinny had never been able to bear being humiliated, and he held his grudges forever.
"That fat old goat will never be able to sire a son," Caroline was saying, "however much Jarvis might wish it."
She cast Sebastian a sideways glance that told him she wasn't nearly as simple as she liked to appear.
"You want to know who killed poor Jane? You talk to Jarvis. He's behind everything that happens in this country. Especially if it's underhanded and dirty."
Sebastian said,
"Why would Jarvis kill Jane Ambrose? Why don't you ask him?" "I did, actually. He denies having anything to do with it. Ach!"
She waved one plump, clay-covered hand through the air in a dismissive gesture.
"He lies almost as much as the prince. Except, of course, he's better at it."
Sebastian watched Caroline frown down at her sculpture and realized she was executing an extraordinarily skilled likeness of her brother, the current Duke of Brunswick. He said,
"I'm told you recommended Jane Ambrose to Lord Wallace as an instructor for his daughter Elizabeth. Is that true?"
Caroline kept her attention focused on the bust's hairline.
"I may have. To be honest, I do not recall."
The evasiveness of the answer was telling. He said, "Did Jane bring a message from Charlotte when she came to see you last week?"
"Huh! What kind of man not only prevents his daughter from seeing her mother, but refuses to allow them even to correspond with each other? Hmm? What kind of man?"
When Sebastian kept silent, she said,
"But you're wrong about Jane. Charlotte never asked her to carry letters." "But she did come here." "Oh, yes, to visit with me. Is that so impossible for you to believe?"
"No, Your Highness. But it doesn't explain why you think Jarvis might be behind her death."
Caroline rolled one round shoulder in a dismissive shrug.
"Perhaps I'm wrong."
It was obvious that she would tell him no more, and one did not press the Princess of Wales, even if she was banished from court. But it occurred to Sebastian, as he bowed himself out, that however uninhibited, unsophisticated, or careless of her dress Caroline might be, She was still very much a princess born and bred, the future Queen of England, and the mother of the heiress presumptive to the throne. She'd known exactly what she was doing when she'd agreed to speak to Sebastian, and she had told him the sordid tale of Charlotte's betrothal for a reason.